The Tom Woods Show, episode 860.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
To all my young listeners, you want to stand out from your peers? Then don't do what they do. Join Praxis, get real on-the-job experience, and a real job. Be entrepreneurial. Get all the details at tomwoods.com/praxis. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're talking today to Anthony Samaroff, who is a libertarian writer in Scotland. He co-hosts the Scottish Liberty Podcast. He's a member of the Scottish Libertarian Party. He gave a talk, I think I mentioned this on yesterday's episode, in front of a group of people who supported, presumably, the basic income guarantee idea. And by the time he was done with his talk, they were cheering for him. So I thought, I got to talk to this guy. How's that possible? So we'll probably talk a little bit about how to persuade people of things, and then some substantive questions about the market economy and tricky questions for libertarians to answer. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Really excited to get to speak to you.
It's been great having you in the private Facebook group, which is now a secret Facebook group, which is even a higher level.
Secret.
Yeah. Now there isn't even a link to it. You have to be my friend, and then I put you in. It's because I kept getting all these spam requests from people to join the group, people who obviously have never even heard of the show.
Right.
And they're just, so I said, that is it. I'm done doing that. Anyway, I've been glad to have you in there because, among other things, I've gotten to know what you've been working on. I want to start off by talking about this YouTube video of you talking about the subject of the basic income guarantee. And you were speaking to a group of people who, by and large, probably believed in the basic income guarantee.
Yes.
And you made arguments that made them, you know, stand up and cheer by the end. And that amazes me.
Thank you.
So I'd like to talk about how you did that. How did you approach that? And what kind of arguments did you think were most likely to reach them?
Right. Well, I had a very conscious approach in writing my speech. And it comes a little bit back to, I don't know if you ever heard of Aristotle's three components of a convincing argument, ethos, pathos, and logos. One is the character of the speaker, ethos. People need to think that you're, you know, a good character that they want to be convinced by. The second one is pathos, or an emotional appeal of the argument. And the third is, you know, the logic. Now, we'd love to think that everyone just cares about reason and evidence, but I think that people really do care about the first two things. So the first thing I did in my talk was I summarized the arguments in favor of the universal income. And they come from, you know, getting rid of poverty traps or welfare cliffs, where when poor people earn more, they would actually be taking away less money. And the acknowledging the contribution of people who do voluntary work, and I could go on. Then what I wanted to do is go through the arguments against it. And I talked about the economic arguments, particularly the, I said, you know, I still think people would do productive work even if they were given universal basic income. But here's the thing. The market rewards people for doing things that other people want them to do. So even if it was worthy work they were doing, it might not be the necessary work. What's more, obviously, you'd have the disincentive. I mean, are people who are going to be working under that system taxed at 70%, 80%, 90% to pay that, and the disincentive that would provide? But as I wore into the arguments against, I could see people's attention span slipping a little bit. What I really wanted to get to was libertarian alternatives, policies, real policy suggestions that would help the poor. I was thinking, I was trying to talk to the values of my audience, and this is, I think, something that people need to get. It's really, really important to identify what other people find important when you try and talk them round and try and speak their language. So there I was thinking, well, you support the UBI because you care about the poor. Now, here are some libertarian policies that would be very helpful to the poor.
Yeah, and I think that is the right way to go. And that actually brings to mind an article you wrote I guess, a year and a half to 2 years ago on how to persuade people of things. Now, I've talked about this a little bit with a couple of guests. Robin Kerner's been on to talk about that.
Right.
Jonathan Haidt has talked about that. And I'd like to know about your particular approach to this, because it made sense to me, even if sometimes, I'm sorry to say, I just don't have the patience to do it.
Right.
I know it would be more effective if I could do it.
Yes. And I found it difficult at times as well. But when you put this into practice and you see the results of it, then it really does help you want to practice it more. And it's one of the first things to do is, if someone says something you disagree with, not jump right in and correct them with facts and evidence. Often a really good thing to say is, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? Or based on what evidence do you believe that, if you can say that in a friendly way, and just give them some time to explain why, because this then positions you, instead of being in an oppositional relationship to one another, you're now engaged in a mutual exploring of the topic. Now, you might be thinking this person's speaking nonsense, but you can have the courtesy to listen to them and sort of nod your head. And if you want to get 10 out of 10, then another thing you can do is, when they're finished speaking, summarize what they've said in your own words in no more than one or two sentences, and make sure you got it right. That goes a long way to creating a emotional connection with people, where they feel like they'd be interested in what you have to say, because you've given them the respect and made sure that you've understood their position.
That makes sense. Now, that is probably something you have to do quite a bit in Scotland, because it's not like any country in the world is a libertarian paradise, but
right,
apparently Scotland sure isn't. What's the population of Scotland?
The population of Scotland's a little over 5 million.
Okay, and the number of libertarians, would you say, is...
Well, we probably had, last year, I'm a member of the Scottish Libertarian Party, even though I considered myself more of an agorist before I came along to the socials and got to know everyone. But, you know, we probably had the most libertarians in one room in Scotland since the days of Adam Smith, and it was a whopping, I don't know, 60. So, and that was people came from all over Scotland to our annual general meeting. But I'm glad to say that since then, the membership's been taken off, and we have monthly meetups in Glasgow, Edinburgh, which are the two main cities in Scotland, and other places in Scotland as well, further afield. And more and more people are coming along. So we're doing hard work to grow the community of libertarians in the otherwise red nation of Scotland.
Well, tell me, what is Adam Smith's reputation in Scotland?
Well, it's an interesting question to ask, because at the universities, you will tend to have an Adam Smith building on campus. But so he's respected as an intellectual, I guess, as is, you know, David Hume, another one of our great thinkers. But it's really hard to know. I mean, I don't think he's not a household name, put it that way. I don't think your average person might have even heard of him.
Stop for a minute. I mean, he's a figure of world historic importance in a country of 5 million. That's astonishing they wouldn't have heard of him. Who have they heard of in Scottish history, if not Adam Smith?
Well, now there's a good question. We have had a lot of inventors and things like that in Scotland. See, I don't know the temperature outside and what the average person thinks. I kind of have, you know, libertarian friends and sort of more mainstream leftish friends. We have a very vibrant pub culture, where one of the favorite pastimes of people in this country is just to go to the bar and get drunk. So I don't know what various people talk about while they do that, but, you know, the men do like to get, myself included, into fervent arguments on whatever's important to them when they drink. But I very much doubt that it would be Adam Smith they would be talking about. And there is a lot of Marxism and socialist feeling in Scotland. But when I became a libertarian, no one in this country even knew what the word meant. When I was in school, I used to just say, when I was in university, I used to just say I was an anarchist to avoid confusion. Now, even those like left-wing thinkers or university students who are interested in politics, they at least know what a libertarian is. And I think as time goes on, they really do have to start contending with their arguments.
Now, what about Scotland and the independence question? Where do you stand on that?
Well, now it's a really complicated issue. If we get another shot at independence, being independent of England might mean going straight back into the European Union, which most libertarians do not support, as it is a far-reaching lawmaking institution. So I was very ambivalent on the independence question because people are very left-wing in Scotland and in the big government statist way. And I feared basically turning Scotland into a socialist hellhole, for want of a more diplomatic turn of phrase, if it was independent. But a lot of libertarians in here are fervently for independence because they think it means a smaller government that's closer to home with holding the whip. And then other people are like, no, it would be crazy. It would be crazy to go independent just because we're more left-wing here than the English are.
Yeah, you know, I did not even think of that, that it's not quite so simple as you would think. That, you know, naturally, we want to smaller units that are closer to the people. But if that smaller unit is then going to take people into a gigantic unit.
Yes.
How is that an improvement?
Yes.
And oh.
Yeah. So it's kind of a bit of a catch-22 here now. And of course, I've spoken. It's not that we like the Conservative Party here. The Conservative Party is terrible. They're absolutely horrendous on civil liberties and on foreign policy. And they're not exactly free marketeers. That, you know, they're corporatists, and they do always increase the size of the state. But In the political landscape, there isn't really much for libertarians, but that's why we exist, and that's we're hopefully creating something for them.
All right, let's pause for a minute to thank our sponsor. Hey, all you young people, if you're not sure that racking up six figures of debt to spend 4 years in an insane asylum is the best direction for your life, then check out Praxis. I recently sat down with Caitlin Scheel, who's just been accepted into the program. Caitlin, you haven't yet started in the Praxis program, but what's been your experience so far?
I have gotten access to an awesome community and network of people that are following the path that I want to follow and have been able to really learn from all of the advisors and gotten some of the bonus material and access to just the brain of Praxis.
You are 16 years old. You're following a path that's very unusual for a 16-year-old. Why are you following this unusual path? What do you hope to get out of it?
I'm following this path because I've always been much more self-directed, and I think that Praxis allows me to go out and create rather than making me wait to do what I love. And that's the whole Praxis philosophy, is going out and creating and not doing stuff you hate.
Get more details and some free goodies when you check out Praxis at tomwoods.com/praxis. That's P-R-A-X-I-S. tomwoods.com/praxis. All right, let's get back to some of the work you've been doing. First of all, tell me about, I do want to talk about the way you've handled objections to capitalism, because you're just good at this.
You
disarm people very effectively. But tell me first of all about the Scottish Liberty podcast. And is there, now, I want to make an appeal, by the way, to anybody listening who lives in Scotland or even is planning to visit Scotland, that I want you to get in touch with Anthony, because he's got meetups, and these are people you would want to get to know, even if you're just passing through. So first of all, make that appeal, and then tell me about your podcast, and is there a reason that non-Scots would want to listen to it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So me and my friend Tom Laird, he came over to record a podcast. We liked it so much that we kept on doing it. We pair together quite well because he's quite visceral and emotional in his approach. He always takes the kind of principled approach, straight down the NAP, you know, don't interfere in my life, don't interfere with other people's life. And I kind of bring more, although he's a very intellectual person as well, and he knows a lot about history that I don't know, I tend to then delve a little deeper, and we go into the theory of the argument. So we've got two, and he's very, very funny. So I definitely think that you should check it out. We don't just talk about topics that are relevant to Scotland. We talk about economics. I like to share about economics, and we go to things that are relevant to libertarians everywhere. But I don't think you will ever feel like your time's wasted if you check out our show. It's funny, it's informative, we've got good banter, and I really think it ticks all the boxes. It's one of my favorite libertarian shows. So
how about that
would be my appeal. Check it out. I'm sure you'll find something in there that you would like.
All right, so that's at, we're going to link to it at tomwoods.com/860. That's 860, the podcast. In a little while, we'll talk about your website and the free goodie that people can get, because I got it.
Sure.
And it looks pretty darn good to me.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it actually covers some of the material that I want to talk about right now, which is, it's especially these days, the market economy is kind of a hard sell, because
right,
it's associated with everything right-thinking people are against.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have a really, really uphill battle. So you have to anticipate a lot of objections. So
right,
give me examples of how you do that.
Well, again, it comes down to, it would be nice if you could just go and give people the logic of the free market argument, but you're not starting with a blank slate, a tabula rasa. People have taken in so much propaganda that's basically anti-free market that you've got to basically be one step ahead of them and preempt what their objections to your objections are. And in my short ebook, Common Misconceptions About Capitalism Debunked, I just went through the most common objections that I come up against online. I thought I'd maybe give people some copy and paste material. If you're tired of banging your head against the wall, answering the same objections to capitalism again and again, then, you know, copy and paste, bring people up to speed to where you are. And then when you hear their response to that, you can have a deeper discussion, so you're not starting at square one every time.
Well, in particular, I mean, really, people should kind of just take your answers, because they're pretty darn good. If they go to your website, antonysamaroff.com, that's two M's, two F's, also linked at tomwoods.com/860, they can download a PDF where you go through argument after argument. And by the way,
right,
I don't know how you did that PDF, but it looks beautiful. I mean, it looks like a Fortune 500 company put it out. How did you outsource that?
Well, I had a friend who was previous, and she did the graphic design on it for me. And I was really, really, really pleased with that. In fact, we were meaning to maybe make a second edition and put a booklet out to give to the welcome packs to our party, to members who join the party. So I'm maybe hoping to have a published edition as well at some point.
All right. Well, it's very much worth getting. You should go to antonysamaroff.com and get this thing. So in your experience, what are the arguments that you have to answer most often, and how are you answering them?
Right. Well, I mean, you get the capitalism is just based on selfishness and it atomizes society and things like that. It's the kind of zero sum game fallacy where, you know, if one person's benefiting, then surely they must be oppressing someone else. And, you know, as we know, in a voluntary transaction, both people turn out better for having made the transaction. Otherwise, in the absence of coercion, why would they bother going into it anyway? There's the idea that capitalists exploit workers, when actually capitalists add value to the labor of workers. Because if you try to do what you do in a factory somewhere out in a field, I don't think you'd make as much money for doing it as you would in that factory. So there's a voluntary transaction going on where the capitalist takes on the responsibility and the risk. And in exchange, you get more for your time than you would working for yourself. Otherwise, you'd just be working for yourself. These are the ones that you hear a lot in Scotland. The big one is that capitalism is bad for the environment. Now, I just put out a podcast this week on the environment question, and I definitely think that people should go to Scottish Liberty podcast and check that one out. It's about 36 minutes long, and I go through like 10 points on how basically free market principles, common law, would actually be better for the environment than the disasters we basically saw in, you know, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Soviet Union, when they actually were under socialism. What do you think are the most common objections to capitalism?
Well, certainly the environment one is big, and I always felt like this was one of our weak points. I felt like our responses are really not that good. Now, in some areas of the environment, like endangered species or whatever, they actually can be pretty good because you look at animals that are, you know, husbanded and owned and cared for. Well, they always reproduce and survive, and ones that aren't don't. That's just a fact.
Right.
Or when, you know, a private spring has much cleaner water than the municipal water supply.
Sure.
Always and everywhere.
Right.
So there's got to be some reason for these things. But in terms of the basic classic case of air pollution, although Bob Murphy just sent me something on this I haven't had time to read yet, I haven't been all that taken by our response to that.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I put out that podcast on environmentalism. And I think one that we should be concerned about is, you know, how are we disposing of our waste? Because there's nowhere are there market incentives in trash disposal. It's just assumed that the government has to do it. So there's not even competition between different agencies to find out how to recycle things better, you know. On a free market, the more difficult something is to dispose of, the more you'd have to pay for it. So the whole economy would change. People wouldn't overpackage things. People wouldn't use planned obsolescence if people thought, well, do you know what? I'm going to have to pay a lot of money to get that appliance picked up. So people would start making things to be easy to repair. They'd start making them out of materials that were easy to recycle because they know at the end of the day, the consumer is going to avoid things that he knows are going to cost them a lot of expense to dispose of. Then people might pick up things like glass and aluminium and tin for free or even pay you for it because those are renewable resources. I've always been concerned with the environment, you know, having come from the left before I became a libertarian. And I guess that's maybe why I do a lot of handling objections, because a lot of the time I'm speaking to my younger self. I had all these misconceptions, which I basically imbibed from the environment. And because no one was really making the case for capitalism, I mean, the conservatives, in the best scenario, kind of apologize for it and say, well, you know, capitalism's not a perfect system, but it's the best we got. No one's out there really making the case for free markets. So that made me overly assured of my positions and believe that my assumptions were true. It's only on reflection that having learned more through YouTube and shows like your own, that I could see around the other side. So I'm always speaking to the concerns of my younger lefter self.
Well, that's actually the way I've handled foreign policy, because
right.
There I am speaking to my younger self.
Right.
Because I always more or less believed in the free market, but I still kind of thought, well, if you don't have government around, then obviously you'll never solve the problems of child labor or working conditions.
Right.
So I would say that's one of the common objections. Poverty is one of the common objections.
Yes.
But that's just a statistical question. You just say, well, look at how poverty's done under liberal economies. And then secondly, I would say on the conditions question, well, you can't have better conditions unless you have more wealth.
Sure.
Because if I just went to the poorest country in the world and imposed the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations on them, are you really telling me that would solve their problems? That would impoverish them even further. You have
right.
to have more wealth.
Yes, exactly. And there's more that we can say on that as libertarians. If you look at the price of accommodation over the last 50 years, at least in the UK, it's gone up over 4,000%. Now, just imagine if the price of rent or the price of a mortgage was half what it is now on average, never mind a 40th. Not only would everyone have so much money left over to have higher standards of living that would allow them to help the poor more, but the cost of looking after the poor would plummet, because one major expense everyone has is the price of accommodation. With free trade across all nations, we could import all our food and other things from countries that have got really poor economies, lifting millions out of poverty. But it would also mean that poor people in this country would have to pay less for their goods and services on a free market than they would have to now. And then there's obviously a lot of money for people on low incomes goes on taxes. Then there's the amount of money that companies are currently spending on complying with regulations. I think I saw that it was 1.88 trillion in the US. I don't know if that's, I couldn't find figures for the UK. That's not just money going, that obviously increases the price of products, but the number of hours that people are being paid to do busy work to show that they're jumping through all these hoops would otherwise be hours they were spending making stuff or doing things that increase other people's standards of living. And then, of course, there's the printing of money by the central banks, which devalues the currency, meaning that poor people's money is worth less. So as libertarians, I think there's a lot more we can say than, well, just compare us here in countries with mixed economies. Obviously, the poor is doing better here than in the third world. Yes, that's true. But we can also make the case for how moving more towards a free market would increase people's standards of living even more.
I'm curious. I know you can't generalize completely about this, but in speaking to people on the left, where you find where they're standing on trade, because what I find is that a lot of people on the right are against free trade because they think it hurts domestic workers, and then people on the left are against free trade because they think it hurts the trading partner, hurts the third world worker.
Right.
So, well, it can't be that everybody loses. Somebody has to win in trade.
Right.
So
someone has to be wrong.
Yeah. So what's your experience with that?
Depending on the person you talk to, when you say, "Oh, we'd be buying products from third world countries," they might go, "Oh yeah, that makes so much sense. That would help them." And then, you know, it's not one of the ones that I can say has come up that much. So perhaps I can go out and test and get back to you on that one.
All right. I'm curious, just because of obviously it's a big, big issue right now in the US. So it doesn't come up much in Scotland?
Oh, right. Free trade. Not really.
Because when you have only 5 million people, it's pretty obvious you have to engage in trade.
Oh, well, that's a good point. Well, now with Brexit, it has come up a little bit, and we were being told that, oh, you know, the sky was going to fall down because we didn't have enough trade deal makers. Why do you need trade deal negotiators? Why can't the trade deal be this long? Do you want to trade? Yeah, that would be cool. Well, there's your trade deal. But, you know, we didn't have a trade deal with India, even though they're English speaking, or New Zealand, even though they're part of the Commonwealth, because some Spanish tomato farmers or, you know, whatever it is, someone in another nation, they want protectionism. So I guess it's been in the media to some degree, but I haven't been actively engaged in debates about free trade. I didn't even realize how big a topic it was in the US at the moment.
Yeah, it's out of control over here, totally. All right, well, listen, I want people to download what you wrote. First of all, because the content's so good. Secondly, the presentation is. It looks like
you've
got a million-dollar foundation behind you, and I love giving that impression to people myself. Right? It turns out it's just me sitting at a desk. You know, they're so disappointed to find out there's no Tom Woods Foundation, just some guy with a microphone. But anyway, so you're doing what I'm doing. I appreciate that.
Okay.
AntonySamaroff.com is the website, and that's 2 M's, 2 F's. I'll link to it at TomWoods.com/860.
I should point out that there's no H in my name.
Yeah, right. It's Anthony. Right. Make sure you get that too. No H. And also, while you're at tomwoods.com/860, check out the Scottish Liberty podcast. Check out the episode on the environment to get you started, and then I bet you'll be hooked on the Scottish Liberty. But don't forget the Tom Woods Show.
Yeah.
Just because there's a Scottish Liberty podcast doesn't mean you're going to forget your old pal Tom Woods. Great that you're doing all this work. You are like, 5% of the whole libertarian movement of Scotland I'm speaking to probably on the phone right now. It's exciting and thrilling, and I'm glad you're doing it. Thanks a lot.
Right. A little less than that. But yeah, I wish you best of luck getting that Tom Woods Foundation and $1 million behind you. And I hope you won't forget Anthony Samaroff when you do found it. Before I go, I really can't leave without saying to your listeners, if you have not joined Tom Woods' private members Facebook group as a supporting listener yet, what are you waiting for? I have to say, I have benefited so much from being in that group. And whenever I have a question about libertarianism or about history, I love to go to that book and that group and ask people's opinions. And you always get really thrilling and interesting answers. They're such a group of well-informed people. And it starts at like $60 a year or something like that. You have no excuse not to join Tom Woods' private members group. And I promise you, you will get more value out of it than you've paid in. Thank you. And Tom didn't pay me an affiliate fee to say that either.
That's very generous of you to say. And you can even pay, it's even 5 smackers a month.
Yeah.
So, and we you're right. We have a lot of fun in there. I appreciate that. And so people would actually get to talk to you, although they wouldn't have the benefit of hearing your incredible Scottish accent, which would be unfortunate,
right.
But they can imagine you speaking it as you're typing. Well, thanks for that plug. I've now had probably maybe 8 people from the group who've now been actual guests on the
right.
show. So that's no guarantee, by the way, you get to be a guest on the show. Let me put that on the table here. You got to do what Anthony's doing, then you get on the show. Well, again, AnthonySamaroff.com, check that out, get that download, and you better get back to work. You got to get another episode of the Scottish Liberty podcast out there. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow we're going to revisit a topic we hit somewhat in an episode not too long ago, the Anti-Imperialist League, which is the group of people ideologically diverse at the turn of the century, that is to say late 1890s, early 1900s, who were opposed to American efforts to subjugate the Philippines. And they wanted to give the Philippines their independence, and they thought that that was the only truly American answer. And it's such an interesting group because they're such unlikely bedfellows, but it's worth talking about, and I'm going to hit that topic tomorrow. So tune in for that, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.